tonight. It is my pleasure to welcome back to Many Rivers Nicholas Egan. He is a PhD candidate in Asian
Buddhist studies.
Buddhist studies at the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco. He has a wide variety of experience in Asia itself, across Asia, has led tours, is extremely knowledgeable about Tibetan art and iconography, and has talked about that here in the store before, and also about Buddhism, and we're really looking forward to this installment of what he has to say. Thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you, Rob and Stuart, wherever he is, and Jim for inviting me back. I love coming to this space. It's very intimate and also profound. I love to be here among the books. So before we begin, in my tradition, it's customary to start with a little blessing. But the blessing itself, it doesn't really come from the person that's saying the blessing. It comes from the people that are hearing it. And the idea is, if you hear the blessing, you're supposed to think that you're going to benefit beings with whatever little piece of knowledge that you get from tonight. Not to say that you necessarily will, but if you do, if you come away with something valuable, something that in the future will be a cause of your own happiness, then may that benefit anybody that you encounter. So it's sort of the rippling outward effect. So just very briefly, I'll chant some funny-sounding words in Tibetan, and if you can set your mind on that, then it's much more profound, because actually the words are just words. It's the felt sense that delivers the meaning. Okay, so just do what you can. So let's talk about limits and the limitless. Actually, before we get started with limits and the limitless, I want to give you something that's been profoundly useful for me in terms of study. Within Tibetan Buddhism, they break everything down. Well, everything that's Buddhist-related, they can break it down into three different ways. The basis, the path, and then the result or the fruition. So you can apply that knowledge to anything. So it's what is it that allows me to attain something? What is it that I'm trying to attain? And then how is it that I'm going to attain it? A good example, let's use Rob. If Rob is looking to have a romantic evening tonight or in a night in the future, that's his result. That's what he's trying to go for. So he'll wake up in the morning and he'll look in the mirror and he'll say, oh, I'm very attractive, man. I'm very witty, man. I am desirable to many different kinds of people. That's his basis, right? So then how am I going to get to my romantic evening in the future? And he'll think, well, I should put on my attractive pants and put on some my nice glasses that I'm wearing, maybe put on a collared shirt, whatever it is, however he gets to that attractive feeling. So the basis is, he sees himself as attractive in all these different ways. The path is, he does stuff to actually enhance that. And then the result is the romantic evening. Right, Rob?
Absolutely.
Good answer. Now, how does that apply to Buddhism? In Buddhism, they talk about Buddha nature. They talk about what is it within us that actually allows us to attain enlightenment. And we're going to talk about that a little bit in a minute. And then in terms of the path, how is it that I actually realize enlightenment? Right? So what do I need to do? What are the steps that I need to follow? In much the same way that a sick person takes medicine, somebody that is trying to attain enlightenment will go on the path. They'll take the medicine of the path, so to speak, meditations or whatever they are, practices. And then certainly, they'll then later attain the result, which is enlightenment. Tonight, we're going to focus mostly on the basis. So what is it that allows us to attain enlightenment? And then the path. How is it that one would attain enlightenment if one were so inclined? So, that being said, the basis, path, and results. Very, very handy. You can take that and apply it to any religion. And I love to do that. My day job is I teach world religions at a private school. And I love thinking in terms of what's the basis of Christianity, what's the path of Christianity, and what's the result that they're trying to teach. Likewise, every religion you can apply it to. Even though it's not within that system itself, still it works. Now, let's talk about the basis. If you read old philosophical texts, especially out of Tibet and India, where India is where Buddhism came from, they often will use examples. So the traditional examples are either a pillar or a vase, right? So we don't have a vase here. Do we have a vase? No. We'll just use this. Let's use a pot. We'll use our pot. I could use my cup, but I don't want you projecting your thoughts on my cup. So we'll use the pot. So when we see this pot, we look at it and it's very clearly defined. You know, this is the pot. We know what it's used for. We kind of can get a guess of how it feels, what it's made out of. We might have a guess on it. Is it clay? Clay pot. We know that it's not something else. So if I were to say, can you please get me a pot? It would be really silly of you to bring a book over. Or if I said, bring me this pot, you wouldn't carry the table somewhere unless you misheard me. So we know very clearly pot and not pot. In fact, we could divide up the entire world. We could take X and not X. So in this case, pot and not pot, right? But that's a very unexamined view of our pot. In fact, in the old Sanskrit text, they call it the goat herder's view. That's a goat herder's view. That goat herders were kind of like the lumberjacks of the ancient world. I hope no one's a lumberjack in here, but the idea, the stereotype of the lumberjack, just kind of like, yeah, that's all there is to it. But in terms of Buddhist philosophy, that's not quite the whole story. So what is the whole story? We can go back to the very beginning and we can talk about the causes of the pot. So I'm imagining some guy taking the clay from a riverbed or whatever it is and then shipping it to the pottery factory, then the potter getting on his, I don't know what, his wheel, his potter's wheel, and making the pot. And then I'm imagining that that goes to some kind of distribution plant. It's then shipped here, and then somebody lovingly placed it out in a display for you all to enjoy. So all those steps are causes, or at least conditions, of the pot being here. Right, so conditions, I'm going to use these words, causes and conditions. They're technical terms. By cause, I mean like a serious reason for it being there. By condition, I mean a secondary reason. But you can just think that they're both causes. So there are causes and conditions for this thing to be here. But that's not all, because each of those causes, so the potter, for instance, he wouldn't be interested in pottery without having a mother and father. He wouldn't even be alive without having a mother and father, etc., back generations. Generations. All those people had to eat food, had to breathe air. All of these things now become the secondary conditions for that potter to exist and eat whatever food he ate that day. Then also the sun comes into play. Welcome. What he ate comes into play. Everything, even his thoughts in a way, add to his understanding of the pot. Welcome if you just came in. We're talking about this pot and why it is not just what it seems to be. So we're talking about the causes and conditions that lead up to this pot. Now, if we follow even one of these conditions back, we can do so theoretically infinitely. Does that make sense? So if I follow even just the one, so there are many, many causes for the pot, and if I pick even just one, so the potter, the primary cause, I can follow that back infinitely, in theory, right? Okay. If I speed up this pot, I know for certain that this pot is going to disintegrate. I can say with utter certainty that somewhere along the lines, this pot is going to dissolve and no longer be what I would claim as a pot, right? It's going to be unrecognizable as a pot. It'll go back to being clay in some way, and then who knows where that clay will end up. So that's in the future. So we've got the past and the future. Now what about the present? In the present, it's actually just my own projection of potness on the pot. Because if I wanted to use it as a stool, I mean, it would probably break, but in theory, I could. If I wanted to use it as a stand, I could. If I wanted to use it as a weapon, I certainly could. So my own preconceived notion of what this is defining it, right? So now we've exploded three kinds of limitation. The limitation of how it began, the limitation of where it's going to go, and even its present limitation of what I'm projecting onto it. Okay?
What's the limitation?
The limitation, which, say that again?
Why are those limitations?
So from the pot's point of view, is the pot, let's give the pot a voice. Of course, it's just a pot, it's inanimate. But if the pot could talk, and we would say, oh, pass me that pot, and the pot heard that, he would say, oh, I'm not simply just a pot. I'm this collection of infinite causes going back, beginningless, right? So it's a collection of all these causes. So the pot itself, he would speak up and say, actually, I'm just a wave, a breaking wave of the totality of the universe, right? It's only your own ignorance or your own projection of those limitations that make the pot seem like a pot. Does that make sense?
Okay.
In theory, anyway. Okay.
The limitation of it as just a pot and without recognizing the infinite causes?
Exactly. Infinite causes, but then also infinite... I was trying to get in the future part. It's also infinite causes for future. It's going on infinitely. So let's call it the interconnection of the universe. Okay? Okay. Just for now. Hold on. Maybe it'll become more clear in a minute. Now, like the pot, so ourselves. Like the pot, so ourselves. It's easy to do with a pot. You can go through and you can do the same thing with a human. We have limited time right now. So I won't go into detail, but what I want to instill upon you is that the mind itself arises as, let's say, it arises at the same time. It simultaneously arises with an object that's perceived. The mind, let's call it consciousness. Consciousness arises with an object to perceive. If there's no object to perceive, there's no consciousness. Okay? If there's no consciousness, then no object to perceive. Mm-hmm. So, if you shift the quality of how you're perceiving any given object into the infinite, so into the limitless, into the infinitude of the universe, likewise, so goes your consciousness, right? So if I remove my conception from the thing itself, I'm removing the limitations from my consciousness. You can go the other way, too. You can say, if I remove the veil that's forcing me, that's trapping me to see this as a limited entity, then I'll see things as they truly are, which is infinite. It's like Blake, isn't it? So what did he say? See infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour, that sort of thing. So he's removing the veil from his awareness. Okay. So that's the basis. That's what allows one to attain enlightenment. Now, when some people hear that, they think, oh, well, everything's just illusion, or everything, I have to get rid of everything, or everything, that doesn't really exist, right? Because that's you could read it a certain way. You could say, Nick, he just said the pot doesn't really exist, therefore there is no pot, right? But we don't want to make that mistake. We don't want to go into, they call it nihilism, thinking that there's nothing at all. Because the pot, the nature of it, hasn't changed. It's only our perspective on it that's changed. Do you see? So the pot's still there. If we can just shift our awareness of it, the pot is still there. If we can shift our understanding of ourselves, things are still there. One of my teachers, an Om Tubsin Rinpoche, always says, your shoes will still be there. You know, you realize enlightenment. You sit down to meditate and you realize this glimpse of enlightenment, and your shoes are still at the door. You know, in Zen they talk about first there are mountains and rivers, then there are no mountains and rivers, and then again there are mountains and rivers. But the third mountains and rivers and the first mountains and rivers, a little bit different. Why? Because you've changed your perspective on them. You've changed your perspective on them. Okay. So that's within the title of basis or base, foundation. I was going to wait till the questions at the end, but I like having the popcorn questions. Any questions about that? No? So let's talk about the... Yeah.
I have a question. When you speak of perspective, then it seems like my relationship to the pot is still mediated by conceptualization.
Mm-hmm. It's problematic because language itself is limited, right? The very reason for language's existence is to define things versus something else, right? So when I'm describing a pot, I'm describing everything else that's not pot by default. So when I'm using language to describe something, when I'm using a limited thing, which is language, to describe something unlimited, it breaks down completely. So what I actually mean is to have an unmediated experience, whatever that means, of the pot. Does that make sense? So in a, to remove that filter completely. So another really common error that actually have fallen into and still do fall into is people will hear that and say, okay, everything's infinite, so I'm going to go walk around and it's like, yep, that cup is infinite. That T is infinite. And then I'll think about all the different ways that it's infinite. Yep, it sure is. And then I'll move over to the statue. Yep, that thing is too infinite. But that's not it at all. That's just heaping your own analytical meditation onto the thing itself. And it's not seeing things directly without a filter. So what we just did was philosophy in order to establish the basis. But in actual practice, what you do is you realize things directly. Is that a little bit more clear? Okay. Do you have a question?
That makes me angry when you say that language is limited.
Yeah, that's good.
Because infinity has its own language. It speaks its own language.
Infinity has its own language and speaks
infinity
its own language.
Infinity is a country. It's a nation, and it has its own language.
Mm.
And if you're limiting the idea of language to words, then I can see your point. Mm. But why would you want to do that?
Well, I was using the conventional usage of language, which generally does mean words. But even that, I can accept your point of if I say language is limited, and you can say, well, no, it's not. That's wrong, because there are literally infinite different ways you can piece together language, infinite meanings or variation within even one word. So in that way, it's unlimited. And I agree. But when I'm talking about meaning and a certain kind of designation of an object, that by definition is limited, because that's the reason that I'm using that language. Because if I didn't use this language, I would say, well, hey, pass me that vast infinitude of the universe. And you'd be like, well, which one? Right? Because take one. And that's not a way that I can get around in the world.
I look at the conversation that goes on between the letters in a word and between the words in a sentence, and the conversation that goes on between my feet and the ground and my butt and the chair, and everything is talking to everything else all of the time. So language is implicit. It's in everything. It's in everything.
And so
the challenge is to when we connect our conversation of words or our language of words with the larger conversation, then we are freeing the words themselves from the limitation of maybe being a little bit too word centered.
Well, that's good. If you can, that's the whole point of the talk, is freeing what previously seemed to be limited and then realizing them as the limitless. So from that perspective, also words or anything at all will reach that result through this same process. So absolutely. So I agree with you on that.
I forgive you then.
Okay. That's good. That's good to know. Yeah, last question, then we'll move on.
Okay, it seems to me that in order to have a direct experience, the only way I can see that would be to actually be whatever the thing is you're experiencing, which means it would be non-dual. There wouldn't be a self and thing you're experiencing.
Yeah. It's true. It's not, you're exactly right. It is non-dual, so it's technically non-dual. It's a little bit different than merging with the thing itself. So there are different ways of parsing what counts as non-dual. And in Sanskrit, it's not, Advaita is the one you often hear that means non-dual. But it could actually mean also like undivided or non-divided. And so it's not so much that I see an object and then I'm merging as one completely with this object. Like I'm taking these two separate things and merging into them, you know, and then I have this. You can absolutely have that experience. People have that all the time in meditation. They call it a samadhi experience, in absorption. But what it's more like is letting that thing be as it is and letting me be as it is and then remove the filter. And then it's not just about me and this thing. It's not just about me and any other thing. It's about experiencing things as just arising in this kind of miraculous way. Okay, well, hold on. Let's get to Pat before we go any further. Actually, Jim, can I trouble you? Thanks. So, Pat. 84,000 different ways to attain enlightenment, according to the tradition. I like to think that just means a lot. Tonight we're going to talk about three, possibly four if we have time, major ways that people, at least in Tibet, have said that these are kind of like the themes of certain people's spiritual practice. First is renunciation. The second is compassion. The third is pure vision. The fourth is... Well, let's call that the direct perception that I touched on just briefly right there. So, the first, renunciation, just means giving up stuff. Giving up stuff. Now, it's a perfectly great thing to do, to give up some stuff. I mean, Lord knows we in the West could learn a thing or two by giving up some things.
By that you mean attachment.
No, not yet. Not yet. I mean actual stuff. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Not that kind of stuff. That's a different. but actually, we'll get there. Traditionally, monks, nuns, they practice this level. So I'm going to give up all my stuff, and then I just have my robe and my begging bowl and, you know, my meditation cushion and that sort of thing. Maybe a book. And that's very positive. It helps. It encourages a non-attachment by giving up some things. And it also allows you to focus on spirituality. Now, anybody that's been to Asia or even been on a short retreat in the West where you have limited belongings with you, you know that even with just a limited... Thanks, Jim. Even with just limited belongings, it becomes very easy to slip into strongly clinging to those limited things, right? So now all of a sudden, yes, I only have my meditation shawl and my cushion, but I really want a nice, slightly nicer meditation shawl, a slightly nicer cushion. What's wrong with that? Nothing. Really nothing ultimately is wrong with that. But I'm still clinging on to stuff, to objects, to phenomena. You see it all the time in meditation centers in the West, you know. The big one, the tricky one is I'll give away everything. I sold my house. I didn't sell it. I gave it all away. And then what they attach to is their renunciation itself, right? So aren't I a great renunciate because I renounced all this stuff? And so they're still clinging even to renunciation itself. You see? So true renunciation is what you said, giving up clinging to things. So that way it doesn't matter if you're wearing a Rolex watch or a mala beads or whatever it is. You're not clinging to whatever it is, whatever the appearance is of these objects. Okay, it's a little bit tricky, and it's easy to say, and it's easy to even think about philosophically, but it's also wise to remember to check yourself once in a while to think, could I really give away? Yeah, I'm practicing this inner renunciation of getting rid of clinging to things, but could I really give it away if I need to? And one time, I'll tell you a story. I was talking to a friend about something along these lines, and he said, and I had just come back from India, and I got a really nice rug, a little carpet, and it was made out of silk, and it was small but very, you know, delicate, nice craftsmanship. And he was saying, yeah, the essence of Buddhism is renunciation, you know, and he had a point. And I thought, yeah, that's true. I'm good because I still have stuff, but I'm kind of, I can renounce some of it. And then I looked at the rug and I was like, no, I'm not doing it. And so I threw my drink on to try to stain it. And I still have the rug to this day, stain and all, to try to check myself a little bit, because it's easy, if you're talking about your internal reality, to think that you're doing it, to fool yourself into renouncing things, but you're not really. So you have to be careful. Outer and inner have to match.
Sometimes. Yeah, nobody can enjoy the rug.
Maybe. Let's try a little renunciation. So don't worry, we won't renounce any people, and your shoes will still be at the door, figuratively. Okay, so just think of something that you really like, something that you don't want to give up. It's not essential, but you really like it. Close your eyes and hold an image in your mind of that thing. And feel how you feel toward it. Like, oh, I'd really like that thing. Whatever it is, it's so nice. It's special. And then keep holding that image. Don't push away the image. But see if you can just let that image be there without any of that feeling coming in. You're just enjoying the mere arising of that image. So you're letting go of it. If you had to, you could give it away, no problem. Okay, now let the thing dissolve slowly. You can open your eyes. Give me just a thumbs up, thumbs down. Easy or hard? What do you think? Let me see. I want to see a show of thumbs. Is it hard for me? Medium there? Hard? Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. It's interesting how things snare us, isn't it? Okay. That's number one, renunciation. Renouncing things. So, there's a very cool story coming out of a sutra, a pretty old sutra, the Vimalakirti Sutra. Vimalakirti was this Indian lay person, so he wasn't a monk, and he lived during the time of the Buddha. He was very realized, so much so that he would often debate some of the monks that didn't have quite such a higher understanding in order to kind of lead them along the path a little bit. So some of the monks were intimidated to go and talk to him. But he invited the Buddha to come and talk and give a big sermon. And wherever the Buddha goes, there are lots of beings that gather to hear. And Shariputra, one of his famous disciples, the Buddha's famous disciples, came and he said, Vimalakirti, you're having this in your house. There are going to be, you know, hundreds of people. We're not going to have room, let alone chairs. There aren't enough chairs. And Vimalakirti looked at him and he said, Shariputra, did you come here for the sake of the Dharma or for the sake of a chair? And that, all of a sudden, Shariputra had a little instance of waking up. You know, Shariputra, he often plays the kind of the straight guy to the straight man to the great master. You know, so whether or not he was just pretending for our benefit, it's hard to say. Okay, so renunciation. Let's leave that for a minute. Let's talk about compassion. It's important to define terms, especially when you're talking about a tradition as ancient and rich as Buddhism, because how we hear certain terms in a modern context isn't necessarily how we hear them as they were meant to be heard in the older context. So they defined all these terms. One is compassion. What it means is actually wishing someone not to suffer. So in order to have actual compassion, you have to have... there's somebody suffering, and then you wish them not to suffer. And that's compassion. And then the kind of flip side, the more positive of that, is loving kindness. We've probably all heard of metta. That's the Pali, an old language of loving kindness. And that's just wanting somebody to be happy. So without the suffering. So you're already okay, but I want you to be even more happy. Right? And these are practiced also with joy, which is just once somebody gets to be happy, you're kind of overjoyed, like, yes, that's exactly what I wanted for you. I wanted you to be very happy. And then also equanimity, which is directed at everybody. So it doesn't matter if it's somebody that's caused you harm or somebody that is very dear to you. You want everybody to be free of suffering, completely happy, and you're going to be joyful when they are happy. Those four are grouped together as the four immeasurables. Now, the reason they're called the four immeasurables is because, number one, they have a measurable benefit for the person practicing them. You literally cannot measure how much impact there is on your mind stream when you're practicing these. But also, and maybe somewhat more importantly, you're supposed to practice them directed at everyone. So there's no limit to who it's directed towards. And in the Buddhist tradition, there are literally infinite sentient beings. Sentient here just means with a mind. So notice I didn't say living beings, I said sentient beings, all kinds of different understandings of what beings mean. Of course, animals, of course, humans, all kinds of otherworldly beings, everybody. Anybody that has an awareness, you're supposed to practice it toward them. Now, what does this have to do with realizing enlightenment? What the teachings say is there are two ways that it can help you realize enlightenment. The first way is that you're getting your mind used to how things really are. So when I talked about the limitlessness of the pot itself, they say that when you realize that, naturally a sense of compassion and care will be overflowing within you. Some texts describe it as bliss, but it's toward other people. It's a kind regard for other people. Very powerful. Effortless. You know, you don't need to generate it like how we do now. Like, oh, if you see somebody you don't like, well, I'll try to be compassionate toward them. Not at all. To a Buddha, it's like, bam, automatically, instant compassion, because they realize that there's not truly a separation between them and everybody else, including themselves. Kind of like what you were talking about earlier, Nancy. Now, that's way number one. Way number two that it helps you on the path is that by extending out your mind to try to touch as many people as you can with this feeling of compassion, of love and kindness, it gets your mind ready to make the jump into the truly infinite. So in the beginning, you start out with this. It's a little bit of a, how should we call it? It's like a false image of infinity. It's not the real thing quite yet until you can then switch and make the jump to remove that veil, that filter. Right? Because usually when people are doing these kind of contemplations, they'll run up into a little bit of a wall, you know, and they can't go much further. Their mind is not used to being expanded quite so large. So those are the two ways. And let's try just a brief practice. I'll walk you through it. So just sit up, close your eyes. And for fun, we'll do loving kindness. I think it's one of the most accessible. And it's very simple. You just think of someone that's new to you and dear to you. Get a picture of them in your mind. And really wish that they were completely happy. Even if they're already happy, just wish that their happiness continues. Get a felt sense for that wish. God, I really want them to continue to be happier, to be more happy. Now, see if you can add a few more people, all people that are close to you, your friends. See if you can keep adding them. And still maintain that same feeling toward all of them. Now, think of a person that you've never met. Hold all those people in your mind, and then at the forefront of this crowd, there's somebody that you've never met, or somebody that you have met that you don't know. So maybe a server at a restaurant that you just had a brief encounter with. that you're neither warm nor cold toward. And see if you can get that same feeling toward them. Now think of somebody that is something of an annoyance to you, if you have such a thing. Somebody that maybe has harmed you in the past. Visualize them there amongst the crowd. And see if you can get that same warm feeling toward them. Now, if you can, try to spread out the crowd, or keep adding people to the crowd. You can add them by the dozens, you can add them one by one. People that you know, that you don't know, people that you like, people that you don't like, and see if you can maintain that same feeling. Now, wherever you are with this visualization, see if you can hold the feeling within yourself, within your heart, that actual sensation of wanting people to be happy. And just imagine that the whole crowd dissolves into light. It just kind of dissipates like a cloud evaporating in the sky. Feel like you yourself are even kind of dissolving like a cloud in the sky, but the feeling remains. The feeling of loving kindness remains, and it pervades that whole area. So that's just a brief toe dipping into the vastness of actually practicing that. As you start to become more robust in your practice, you are practicing it at all times, ideally if this is the path that you're choosing. So anybody that you come across, you automatically are generating this feeling. Like I said, hopefully at some point it shifts into being an effortless practice. That's the idea. So I'm going to shift into, I think, the last aspect of the path that we're going to talk about. And it's pure vision, Daknam in Tibetan. There are a lot of teachings and practices regarding pure vision. Far too much for me to go into even in one night. But I can tell you the essence or the beginning of it. Given that what it is that limits my experience of a pot, that is to say, my projection of potness onto the pot, like that also, my experience of people in general is actually mostly my own projection onto them. Okay? So if somebody's annoying, somebody is not annoying. So I like this one and I don't like this one. Not you, just this one. There isn't any annoyingness here and non-annoyingness here, right? So if I were to cut them up and find the annoyingness, it's even if it's in the annoying action or the loveliness, if I were to cut them up, where is that loveliness? It's within me. So beauty literally is within the eye of the beholder. Annoyingness is within the mind of the beholder. Let's say that. Now, that being said, that means that we're free to create how we experience things, right? So if my filter or expectation or choice of how I experience things is up to me, then why not make it the best I possibly can? So in practice, what this ends up being is having the sneaking suspicion that everybody is enlightened. At one point, at a later point, including you, so you can visualize that there are all kinds of visualizations, so actually seeing somebody as fully enlightened. But at the heart of it, it's this real nagging sense that maybe, just maybe, everybody already realized this. Maybe the entire universe has completely realized enlightenment, and they're all kindly aspiring to help me by being here, and by being annoying, and by helping me with patience, and by manifesting as somebody that's kind, and by showing me how to act. All these different ways, all the manifestations of my experience, maybe, are actually the display of enlightenment. Maybe. Okay? So, the practice then, you seal this kind of practice with a certain kind of, with meditations that are focused on mantra. So you'll see people that chant mantra and who knows, maybe they are or are not realized, but if they are moving in this direction, then they're kind of thinking, well, maybe, you know, maybe the divine within everybody is shining through. And then at some point it's like, well, maybe I am too. And so you can visualize yourself also. Even though it's just a fabrication, it's not the actual experience. But it's in line with moving toward realizing enlightenment, right? And it makes our minds more capable or more susceptible to be able to do that quick shift, that really brief glimmer of the actual state of things, the actual infinitude of realization, right? So we're getting used to kind of how it feels. It's a lot of what counts as the path is just getting used to. In fact, there's a saying in Tibet. It's like there is no meditation. There's only getting used to something, whatever it is you're trying to get used to. So that's a big topic. There are all kinds of, just volumes. We can point to tons and tons of volumes talking about how to further that realization. In Tibetan Buddhism specifically, they say that way is the path par excellence. That's the fastest way to achieve enlightenment. But that being said, if you can't practice it, or if there's something wrong, you know, it's off-putting to you, then of course that's not the fastest way to enlightenment. Then another way is the fastest way to enlightenment, because you don't want to practice that way. But in Tibet, the general consensus is that that's a very excellent way to realize it. Now, I want to leave more time for questions, so I'm going to leave off talking about a more direct perception. But suffice it to say that those are all methods in order to realize a certain thing, what we truly are and how the world truly is. If your mind or your consciousness, your awareness is sufficiently prepared, then with the right causes and conditions, it's possible to just lift the veil all at once, right? If it's just a mere veil and it's all within us, with the right touch, you can remove it. And so there are all kinds of stories, and even today, many people, Westerners included, that have glimpsed the reality of what we're talking about tonight just through a mere symbol, like what you were saying, just through a mere gesture, just through one of their teachers looking at them in a certain way. And it's possible. It's something that I've seen for myself with many practitioners, so it's alive and well. We'll leave it at that. So let's open it for questions and then have a little conclusion. Anybody have any questions? If you don't, I can talk all night.
What's your view of the purpose or the place of the teacher?
That's interesting.
Necessity or not?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. So from how you could tackle that a few ways. So from the point of view of what we're talking about now, teacher, you know, capital T, guru, lama in my tradition, how I'm seeing them, whether they're enlightened or not, is actually my own level of enlightenment. So if I see them as, oh, he's a really wise and beneficial guy, he's not necessarily enlightened and not even a saint or anything like that, but he's knowledgeable, then actually that says more about my realization than that person's realization, right? And if I see them as fully enlightened, then it's a possibility to really get a glimpse of what it means to be fully enlightened, whether or not they're fully enlightened. So there's a story about this, and it's the dog's tooth. Have you heard of this? There was a son, and he was a merchant, and he went to India, and his mom said, you know, bring me back a tooth of the Buddha. And his son said, okay, I will. Yeah, right. Thanks. Bye, mom. I'll see you later. He comes back after a year, doesn't do it, comes back again. She begs him. After another year, please do it three times. And so finally she says, I'm going to kill myself if you don't bring me back a relic of the Buddha, a tooth of the Buddha. He goes to India, forgets completely. And then on the way, he sees the place where his mom lives. And he thinks, oh God, my mom, she might actually kill herself. I need to get something. So he sees an old dead dog, completely bleached out. And he sees the skull and he takes the tooth. A dog's tooth, wraps it up in a beautiful silk thing, and with much ceremony brings it to his mom and says, Mom, I present you with the tooth of the Buddha. Mom's overjoyed, completely crying. You know. She puts it on her altar, and actually believing that it's the tooth of the Buddha, does practices, all kinds of prayers around it, ends up realizing enlightenment. And just based on her supplication of this tooth of the Buddha. So where was the blessing coming from? The blessing was coming from her. It's her own belief. So just like that, a teacher, your belief in the power of a teacher or the enlightenment or the level of a teacher, that's where you're getting the true blessing from. And any teacher, at least within my tradition, that's worth their salt, will tell you that straight out. You know, that's, don't rely on me, the man. Rely on the Buddha nature kind of guru as you see it. And it's up to you to have the pure vision to connect with those blessings. Because ultimately, it's only a reflection of your enlightened nature. So whether or not you need a teacher is completely up to you. And how you define teacher is also completely up to you. Because with enough faith, faith is bad, but with enough confidence that the world actually is an enlightened place, then the world itself becomes your teacher. And actually, that's where they're striving to go. That's what you're striving to do. So if you can rest in that, then everything becomes your teacher.
Okay. How would I know if I'm really using the world as my teacher, though?
Yeah.
I could walk around just saying, oh, yeah, this is all my teacher. And
easily, yeah. People do that all the time.
Yeah.
And then they'll wander into Dharma tea. Yeah, exactly. Well, Sebastopol, it's its own pocket of pure land. So the way that you test whether the path is working for you or not is, number one, how you're treating people. So is kindness and compassion actually more manifest? Are you behaving more gently toward people? Are you getting some peace of mind? Do you feel a sense of joy arising more and more? Or are your limitations, are your self-imposed limitations breaking down in a way that allows you to interact with people in a better way? Or are you just adopting a system of beliefs? Yeah, the world is my teacher, and my teacher says you're an idiot, right? Is that if you're going that way, then no. But if you're going the other way, then maybe yes. But I would say that at a certain point, whether you take a guru, capital G, or somebody that's maybe a little bit further along in the path, a teacher is very beneficial. in some ways. But if you have a, if there's the idea that I must get a teacher in order to attain enlightenment, then no, that's not it at all. Is that ambiguous enough?
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe.
More practical answer, go check out teachers. Mm-hmm. See if you have any flash with them, mm-hmm. you know, and then hang out with them. Spend a few years. Don't just go jump in to a marriage with a teacher, the first teacher you see. That's a recipe for disaster. Spend at least a couple years, or maybe a year at the bare minimum, getting to know the teachers. And go see some teachers. And beware of any teacher that says, don't go to other teachers. That's, in my mind, a big red flag. And also in the Buddhist tradition, some of the only, actually literally the only fraudulent teachers I've ever met, one of them I asked, I said, well, who's your teacher? You know, that's like, you should be able to answer that, because every teacher also reverences their teacher. And then she said, I am the teacher. I thought, oh, really? Okay, well, then let's, when we talk more, and it was very clearly not a good thing that was happening there. So just be careful.
It could have been the dog's tooth.
That's exactly. See, and that's what a true... See, I was using my own limited mind. And from my perspective, yes, clearly false, not good. But really what I should do, and what other lamas have told me, like, well, you don't know. You don't know. Maybe she's manifesting as a false teacher in order to help beings find other teachers or something like that. You should change your pure vision. But be very careful and so that that doesn't let you become complacent and become abused. Do you know what I mean? It's a little bit of a fine line.
It seems like maybe is a really important part of what you're saying, because I'm thinking, well, it sounds kind of like what you believe is you create your own reality, or kind of these pop phrases. But if it's training the mind to see things a certain way, it seems like the maybe everyone's enlightened, that the maybe is really important. As a step, because otherwise, at least the way I'm taking this right now and myself, is that it seems kind of like wish fulfillment or mm-hmm. too kind of airy-fairy to really mm-hmm. Grab a hold of.
Right.
But as an exercise, to see it as maybe everyone's enlightened and to watch your own attitudes and how you behave, it seems like it could be helpful.
Yeah, that's I really like what you're saying. I often think that you could write a whole commentary on Buddhism based on just the word maybe. Because what you're actually trying to do, what the result of the Buddhist path is to try to realize everything as free of limitations, which isn't to say to project that on, but to realize it has limitations. But as practitioners, what often happens is, well, what do Buddhists believe? Now I believe that thing. And now, what do Buddhists do? Now I do that thing. And all you've traded was your previous belief system for another belief system, and you've gotten nowhere. There's what benefit is there to that? You know, the whole point is to remove the veil that traps you, you know, to attain freedom. So that's where you're moving toward. So I like to say maybe, because it's a little bit, it's gentle, but it's also kind of prodding you along. If I say everybody's enlightened, period, realize it. You know, get on board. It's kind of dogmatic in a very limiting way.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's any other way to be dogmatic, but at least that way. You had a question in the back.
I really appreciated what you said about when you see a teacher and you recognize that they have a certain attainment.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reflection of your own attainment. What I grapple with is devotion to the teacher. Having met now a couple of teachers who I feel are in that category, turns into attachment and clinging to the teacher, and it's very hard to separate. When we talked about one of the steps is renunciation,
mm-hmm.
you see someone in whose presence, you know, you have a glimpse of things. How do you avoid the attachment that arises?
If you see someone and you have that spark, and you're like, wow, that person, I get a certain feeling around them. It's very freeing. I think that they are actually legitimate, authentic, realized teacher, whatever that means, and I'm going to follow them. Then how do you keep from being attached? Is you don't, if you're still after, I mean, of course, in the beginning, as a beginner, yes, the teacher, go hang around the teacher. I want to be near the teacher drink from the cup. I too want to drink from the cup. You know, that's all a form of blessing. It's a very, it's excellent. And that's kind of the beginner's view. But sooner or later, you have to realize teacher is really just a manifestation of my own enlightened nature. That teacher, you know, he himself from his side also is enlightened, but also my experience of it is just a manifestation of my enlightened nature. And if that's the case, well, then why am I limiting my experience of enlightenment to the time when I'm around Guru Joey? You see? So the task then, once you have a teacher and have realized a taste of that, how do I do the yoga of the Guru in manifesting enlightened nature in everything? How do I see everything as not necessarily my teacher in the way we were talking about it, like teach me something, but as a display of enlightened nature? Because that's the essence of a teacher. Another question. Yeah.
The teacher gets a lot of attention. I don't think the student gets enough. Because I think that to truly be in the moment is to be somehow to be learning.
Yeah.
I think when I'm learning is when I feel most human, mm-hmm. most myself, and so I think the real teacher in the moment is not identified as that. I'm so wary of that identification, and suspicious of it, and I so shy away from it, because it almost implicitly disallows the kind of equality which I think the word equanimity is really important to me in the field of enlightenment study, and anything that challenges the real sense of equality, I would say, is somehow hindering the reality, the real perception.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. And I don't hear anything that I'm saying as dissing any other tradition, but within Tibetan Buddhism tradition, a legitimate teacher, I mean, there's all kinds of yogas and meditations all centered around your teacher. But at the end of all that, you're supposed to dissolve it all within to you as just a constant reminder that it's all coming out of you. And I agree, if you set up that power dynamic, that itself can become an obstacle to realizing what you're trying to realize. So we don't want to do that. Absolutely not. But for what that's worth, yeah.
Well, if your perception is that everything you encounter has something to teach you, you're not fixated then on a teacher necessarily. You're trying to examine what everything you encounter means and what the teaching is. So I think that frees you from this kind of attachment.
It should, ideally, yeah. But everything has there's always the danger of taking something else as a new attachment. You know, I mean, that you can also go into the realm of, everything is my teacher. Therefore, this guy punching me in the face, what's he trying to teach me? And there's some benefit to that. But then on the other hand, would you let yourself be abused? You know, that maybe is straddling the line between very psychologically unhealthy, I would say, as opposed to spiritually liberating. So yeah, it's just, you know, constantly be careful. I love the mantra of maybe. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe.
Well, physical abuse is another thing. I don't think that has much to teach you, except avoidance.
Well, maybe. maybe. But, in fact, Naropa, he's one of the most enlightened beings. He's lived in India about 800 years ago. And his guru gave him some teachings and told him to do certain kinds of meditation. And how he attained final enlightenment, his guru took off his sandal and hit him on the head really hard. And then he attained enlightenment. So, you know, you never know. Any other questions?
Put a big maybe on that one.
You can. Yeah.
How would you describe final enlightenment?
Oh, I'll tell you when I get that. That's difficult. There's a book called On Being Buddha. And it talks about, it takes all the snippets from his teachings and talks about what it's like to actually be a Buddha. I can tell you, you know, let me back up just a minute. And there's something, another interesting way of categorizing experience. And they talk about understanding something. So having an intellectual understanding and then having an experience of something and then having a realization of something. And the realization bit is permanent. The experience is temporary and the understanding is just knowledge based, right? So I can talk from my own experience, which is not nearly the same as realization. But I can say that glimpsing even just a little bit of what we're talking about is freeing and naturally blissful, if that has any meaning, joyful, just completely natural in a sense, because you don't want to think of it as something grafted onto your experience. Now, whether or not that has anything to do with being a Buddha, I have yet to experience. But some traditions will say, yeah, just learning how to live in that, from that realization, that's sort of the essence of being enlightened. That's one way. I mean, it's much more popular within the philosophical tradition to describe it as what it's not like. And the example they give is if you're a frog trying to describe to a fish what it's like outside of the water, you know, and the fish is like, well, is it like this over here? Not exactly, no. And then, you know, is it like that over there? No, not exactly. And even if you really think about it, even ordinary experience, like if you've never experienced sugar, and then you ask, well, how is it to experience sugar? I can say, well, you'll say, is it like salt? Not quite. Is it like celery? Not quite. You know, but how do I really impart what it's like to taste sweetness to someone that's never tasted it? Or, and how is it for us, since we've never had that taste of enlightenment yet, how is it, how are they going to describe it? You know, it's beyond, they say it's beyond words, which is a little bit unpalatable. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Or not, it's a non-answer to your question.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I don't know if that was the best question. The reason why I ask is, no, you can't answer the question, but you made reference to realization in your talk more so than most other people do, which I thought was kind of interesting. So I was just curious if you had any pointers, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, I think that there's a real danger, and I just really I try to be as against this danger as possible. Within America, to say enlightenment, forget it. Don't even worry about it. Just be present now. Just be mindful now. Just, you know, do your breathing. Be calm. Be a kind person. Don't worry. There's no such thing as enlightenment, or that's all enlightenment is. And I think that that's losing something. That's losing something that's a beautiful... The realization is living from a space of understanding that, and then everything's flowing from that, as opposed to doing a practice and then trying to get to a certain state. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And I think that that gets lost a lot in American Buddhism, and much to the detriment of the tradition, in my opinion. And I do think that, of course, it is different, experience and realization. But it's possible. Because once you have the experience, it's like going to Spain, right? If the understanding is I'm going to read my guidebook to Spain, I understand all about Spain, then the experience is I went to Spain for a week, and I experienced Spain, and it was great, but I had to come back. The realization is now I live in Spain. You see the difference? So once you have the experience, it's much easier to talk about the realization.
Well, okay, another question then is the fourth path of direct perception.
Mm.
Direct perception of what? Because if none of these... so I get the aspect that it's a shift But here again, it's a shift of what, you know. Mm-hmm. And back to the maybe thing, maybe yes, maybe no.
Right.
And, you know, so there's a sense of unknowingness, and so you never really know.
Yeah, there's a sense you never really know what. I'm sorry, I could.
You don't
never really know. Yeah. Period. Yeah. The not knowingness. Actually, you hear that a lot in Buddhist and other traditions. So it's a not knowing. That doesn't mean not having any kind of awareness, right? When they talk about the not knowing, it's like, well, I finally get what it means to be enlightened. And they say, nope, it's not just that. Because once you fixate on it, it's not that. Maybe it was to begin with. But as soon as you crystallize it, then it's no longer that. It's just a facsimile of the experience. Mm-hmm. You know, so maybe you do have a brief realization, and then the mind is very sneaky. It crystallizes that, and it can replicate that in terms of your own practice. But it's not the direct thing itself. You've now put another layer in front of it. And so going back to the question of what is it that you're actually comprehending? What are you actually seeing or doing or experiencing? Mm-hmm. If you talk about it in terms of a thing, you've missed it entirely. But that's not to say that there's not something to experience. Do you know? I mean, there's volumes of philosophy to talk about how it's not something, how it's not nothing, how it's not both something or nothing, how it's not neither something or nothing. Because any kind of grasping onto it, you're limiting that thing if you grasp onto it at all. So it literally is just being with awareness in such a way that things arise as the enlightened state themselves. Okay.
So you're going to rest in a state of unknowing.
You could say it like that, but that sounds to me more like in kind of almost a delusional or ignorant kind of state. So like if I'm knocked out unconscious, I'm resting in a state of unknowing. I don't know anything, but that's not at all enlightenment. Enlightenment is a clear realization of the infinitude in it arising. Go ahead.
Not trying to make something particular.
You're not trying to make something particular out of it, yeah. At the final, in the direct perception path. Yeah, that's right. You had a question?
I just want to add to that a little bit from two things, but one, in the teachers I've been around, you talk about it as knowing your own true nature, who you really are. And one of my first teachers many years ago wrote a spiritual autobiography, Muktananda, and he wrote at the end, as he was going along, he said, but I still had doubts. Yeah, he knew he still had doubts, even though he attained a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He said, when I reached that final realization, there were no more doubts.
Right.
And it's kind of like the sense that he described it as when someone says, you know, do you know who your father is? You know. Mm-hmm. I mean, most people know. I mean, if you know who it is. There's no doubts. It's immediate. And he was saying like that, there were no doubts anymore. When he had the final realization, I knew who I was. And so it's like I can't describe what his state is, but I can understand that that's when you know that there no one from outside will tell you it. You'll know it.
Yeah, that's a nice way to say it, but there is also a danger with that, because I can tell you from my own experience, you know, you spend years studying philosophy and understanding, okay, I understand how it is. I know, I have no doubts philosophically about it. But then if you all of a sudden get a glimpse of it, it's like, oh, you see it completely differently. But it's still, all the philosophy was right, but now it's like you understand it a little bit differently. It's like studying water your whole life and then all of a sudden drinking it. A little bit different than knowing and experience. So that's what
the knowing is. That,
yeah.
It's an non-conceptual, experiential knowing.
That's not bad. Non-conceptual, experiential knowing. I like that. Okay, I think we're at time. But you all have been fantastic. So thank you so much. It's been my pleasure. Again, I just want to thank Rob, Stuart, and Jim. They're just gems within the community. And they're all teachers in their own right, whether or not they're actively teaching or not. And they have such good hearts that you just can't go wrong being around them. So please do take advantage of that as much as possible. Okay. Thank you.
And on behalf of Many Rivers, I want to say with confidence that was maybe the best talk you've given.
Well said, well said.
So thank you. with confidence for coming tonight and enjoying this space and this wonderful speaker. And we have, as most of you know, instituted the Buddhist custom of dana, or generosity. There is a donation bowl there on the counter. We encourage you to contribute to it and to thereby support the work of our speaker, as well as helping to maintain this space. I also want to bring to your attention that we have a lot of books here. This is one I read relatively recently, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, which sort of touches on some of the themes that we've been talking about tonight.
That's an excellent book. Actually, he's one of my root teachers, Songsar Khyentse Rinpoche. And also, I really strongly recommend this red book or this blue book. Both are excellent. Yeah, Secret of the Vajra World and Indestructible Truth. Either of these, especially this blue one, is going to get at some of what we were talking about today. Really, really, those are just treasures of a book. Light Comes Through is excellent. It's Up to You. Zero Control is great. These are biographies, you know, so you can learn a lot, but those are more direct, and this one's excellent too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good to see you.
I'm going into the hug.
Yeah. Hey, congratulations.
Thank you.